Hi, everybody. Welcome to this session with Ron Kitchens. I think you're going to really enjoy what he has to say, and I'm looking forward to this interview. Ron, thanks for being with
me. Oh, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be with you today.
Great. So let's start here. Your company is called Southwest Michigan First, which is a very specific geography. And I want to kind of cut right to the chase to make sure our listeners understand that is not only who you serve. So tell us a bit more about kind of your big vision. What is it that you're here to do in the world? What's your moonshot?
So you're right. We serve nationally. We've got clients in 38 states in the past 6 years, we've had about 60,000 people who have gone through training and development with us. So we want to be the teaching hospital version of a development company. So we work with companies, communities, individual leaders, and, as Don Miller taught me to say, we want to be the Miracle-Gro for their leadership and growing their companies. So our focus is working with leaders to take their organizations to the next level.
Awesome. And what's your sense of how business and entrepreneurship can be a resource for solving the world's biggest problems?
So I fundamentally believe, and if I had the courage to get a tattoo, my tattoo would say the greatest force for change is a job. So we believe the greatest thing we can do is help companies create private sector jobs. And I grew up in abject poverty. Neither of my parents finished the eighth grade. My father, who suffered from the same dyslexia that I have, could never learn to read. And was killed in an industrial accident when I was four because he couldn't read the sign that said, "Don't do this." And I grew up knowing that the people I envied, I didn't envy them for the house they had, although we moved 13 times before. I went to 13 different elementary schools before the sixth grade. I didn't envy them for the fancy cars. I envied them because their parents had jobs. And those jobs meant that they had power, that they had influence in their own lives. And so that's really what I've dedicated my life to, is working with organizations and individuals to create jobs so we empower people to take care of their own families.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's pretty extraordinary. And so how long have you been doing this, working with people and leaders to develop this?
So I, started at age 20. I actually goes back earlier than that. I couldn't afford to go to college. So I knew I had to go part-time, and I had a great mentor who helped me, and I bought a gas station at 18 years old. And I ended up being pretty successful at that, and I owned a lot of gas stations and convenience stores. But I had just closed on a deal, just actually paid off a loan. And my banker, I was telling him how excited I was going to be able to hire all these new people. And he said, you care more about hiring people than you do making a profit. And I said, exactly, you finally get me. And he said, I didn't mean that as a compliment. We have to find something else for you to do that, you want to do more than you can do in this life you're leading. And so I worked my way out, sold all the businesses. And by the time I was, 26, so 30 years ago now, I dedicated my life to this belief that the greatest thing I can do is help people own their own futures, help families take care of themselves, and in de facto, that means communities get better, churches get better. Everyone wins when families have jobs.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. So when you're doing the work you kind of do, obviously you're working with a lot of business leaders. What's your sense of what are some of the biggest changes and challenges facing business leaders today?
That's a great question, because it is different. 15 or 20 years ago when we were working with leaders, it was technology wasn't changing. You know, money was fairly plentiful, but we worked a lot on financing issues and helping companies grow around that. Today, it's about the increased demands that technology is putting in their lives, whether it's demands on their time and managing that, or it's demands in being a constant and consistent change agent. And yeah, I was just with a group of leaders that I mentor, as 8 leaders in there, 3 of which publicly traded companies, 3 of which are, you know, mid-sized, very large family businesses, and 3 of which are entrepreneurs, and all of them dealing with the same exact issues of how can they be highly engaged in their businesses, but constantly be telling people we have to change. If we're not constantly changing, then we become irrelevant. And that's something really difficult these days, because, you know, humans by their sheer nature struggle with this idea of constant change.
Yeah. There's an interesting dynamic, which is now more than ever, it seems you have a choice. You can either be disrupted or you can be disruptive, but you don't really get a chance to just stay.
You don't. Yep.
So that sounds right.
At all. And it's exhausting. And that's why I think we're seeing and hearing a lot more about leaders burning out. That's why, you know, it's so important in those leaders and companies that we coach, and I know your heart is around this idea of engaged teams and making sure that we're doing things as teams, because a leader who believes it's all on their shoulders can't last long enough. There's just not enough energy then to adapt to all of the change that's happening, and you become a victim of it instead of a victor.
Yeah. So when you think about this, here are these massive disruptive changes that are completely altering the face of business. What new leadership capacities do you think are required to lead well in this world? Like, how is leadership changing as a result of these kinds of changes?
You know, I think it is a different, it's not so much that leadership is changing, is you have to amplify different aspects of leadership. So, you know, I grew up in, you know, the old hierarchy of business, where early in my career, after I'd graduated from college, I had a different banker than the one earlier in the story come to me and say, hey, we'd like for you to join our bank. And here's the deal. You're going to work your tail off for 25 years, and we're going to pay you terrible. But at the end of 25 years, we'll make you rich, and you can go out and lead in the community and, you know, be the, you know, president of this, and you can run for mayor, and you can do whatever you want. But that's what it looks like. And even at that point in my career, I thought, I don't want to wait for any of those things. But that was what the hierarchy looked like for most people. Today's leaders, particularly Generation X and Millennials, they're not willing to wait for their time to lead. They have all the access to the world's knowledge, and what they're looking for is somebody to tell them, help them discern that knowledge, and help them fly at a pace faster than a lot of us ever imagined possible. And so my job as a leader used to be top down, and I was the visionary from the mountain. Today, my job is that mentor coach that helps our leadership team, those we coach. We have about 30 people on our team who are working with clients, and so helping them understand, it's the discernment of what to do with information and knowledge today. It's far more exciting and different than anything that's ever been done really in the history of the world. This is the best time in the world to live and be a leader.
That's really exciting. And so, you know, part of what this theme of this telesummit is around helping people respond to what is effectively rapid, accelerated change driven by technology, like you mentioned, and you've alluded to some things that are shifting, not least of which is, instead of I'm the visionary and I'll kind of handle it all, to We have to become actually coach as leaders rather than just visionaries. What are some of those leadership capacities that you kind of look at and go, you know what, as fast as everything in the world is changing and as fast as the workforce is changing, there are actually some things that haven't really changed. What are some of those leadership capacities, requirements that have stayed constant in your experience?
Learning is the number one thing. You know, it almost has become a cliche to say leaders learn, but that is it. I have never worked with a great leader who wasn't a tremendous learner. And, you know, on our team, you know, our team is required to read 6 books a year. So we do that as a collective, and we have a book club that we do that. Generally, I select the book because I'm reading between 40 and 50 books a year. So I'll find one that I think really matters to our team. Herding Tigers was the most recent book that we finished just this past Tuesday. And but we also require
a great
leadership
title.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, instead of herding cats, it's herding tigers.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
And,
yeah, that's really smart.
Yeah. And so, but we also require everybody on our team, the first year you join, there are 13 books that you have to read over that 13, over that first year, because if you don't, you won't get our culture. We'll make references.
Wow.
You know, good to great is one of those things. And we'll talk about, well, go to your hedgehog principle. And if you don't know what that means, then you're left behind. And so ignorance is something we can't allow as leaders. And now we're agnostic about how you consume the book. So whether it's an audio book or digital or a print copy, you can do it any way you want, but you do have to consume it. And that's part of our culture. Every organization I've seen that's thriving are learning-based organizations, and I think that's critical. You know, and then we, on the months we don't read books, we're reading case studies. And, you know, Harvard's made their case studies, Stanford's made theirs available, Northwestern, University of Chicago. And so we'll pick a case study that is a problem or a future issue that we want to teach against. And then we'll do it just the same way they would in the best graduate schools in America. And, you know, you can buy that case study for, I don't know, $7 each or something. And so it's critically important that leading organizations are learning organizations.
How can our listeners get a hold of the list of 13 books? I'm sure people would love to know what they are.
Yeah, it's at ronkitchens.com. If you go, those books are listed there.
Awesome. Thanks. Okay. So let's turn for a minute now. I want to get a little bit more specific. You know, this is, I want listeners to both be able to have kind of big picture perspectives, new frameworks, new ways of thinking, but also some more practical stuff. We'll kind of transition there now. Your company has won a lot of awards for being the best place to work. Maybe just help the listeners know a bit about some of those, Wall Street Journal outside, and then I'll lead into a question about that.
Yeah, so the Wall Street Journal named us one of the 30 best businesses in America to work for. Outside Magazine named us in their top 20 on 3 occasions. The Best Places to Work, that organization, twice named us the best business in America to work for, and we've been in their top 10 for 7 or 8 years now. The International Asset Management Council named us their global innovator. Fast Company named us to their Fast 50, and we do all of that as an organization that was founded as a not-for-profit but has converted itself to a social entrepreneur organization. So we work both sides of it, and so we're the only social entrepreneur group that's, I think, ever been on any of those lists. And so
you have some credibility then. For this next question, which is ultimately what you're talking about is kind of the HR language for that is called employee engagement, of course. Why is employee engagement important? Why does that matter?
It matters because for us, that's the asset we own. And I shouldn't say own. That's our asset of the organization is our people. And, you know, we own a bunch of old desks and some new computers. But other than that, our product and what we provide to the world are amazing people. And, you know, if you look at, and we've studied it, we work on the area of engagement with a couple hundred companies a year. And what we know is those companies, the higher level of engagement they have within their teams, the higher profitability they have, the higher the satisfaction is of their customers, the more people they have come through their doors on Sunday to church, the more charitable contributions they have for their not-for-profit. So we know that people, customers, consumers, parishioners, come to places and organizations based on the quality of the people. In it, where products have become commodities in our lives, there are very few unique products. What there are unique people and organizations, and if you want to be successful, that's what success looks like. Plus, I get to hang out every day with 30 of my best friends, 30 people that you know, and our team. You can't join the team unless you get a thumbs-up selection vote from every other member of the team. So every person who's here selected every person who followed them. And in my church tradition, they baptize babies. And so, but at the end of the baptism, the minister says, now, will you as a congregation stand and will you make a commitment to support this child for the rest of its life? When we add somebody new to our team, we ask them not to just say yes or no, but if you say yes, you have to write me a note that says, yes, Ron, I think we should add Stephanie to our team, and I'm committed that her success or failure is a direct reflection on my leadership. And so, but if you have a team that owns the relationships, owns the success, there's no artificial barrier that's going to stand in your way. That's why it's so important. And frankly, it's just easier. You know, every leader I work with, I say, what do you hate most about working with people? And it's the discipline issues you have, and you have to fire people, and you know, you have all these, you know, awful things around the human condition. Well, I haven't fired anybody in years. And, you know, and we don't keep track of vacation days because people take what they need. You know, we treat everyone here as their CEO of their own responsibility, and they perform at that level. That's what engagement's all about.
Great. Thank you. Okay, so and for the listeners, I want you to know there's a valuable resource Ron's going to share at the end. So stay to the end. You're going to like it. I think it's going to be really helpful. And I'll just tease some of that right now before we offer that at the end. And that's a free resource. So kind of give us the inside scoop, just the basic simple idea. What's your sense of the best way to drive employee engagement, which clearly is driving big results?
Yeah, so for us, we looked at that. As we were winning all these awards and we were working hard around doing all the right things every day, we thought, you know, we ought to categorize what it is that we do. As we grow and we've got now multiple offices, how do we make sure that we don't lose our culture? Because that's our asset. That's that valuable asset. So we created this idea around preeminence. And for us, we define, you know, preeminence as this idea that it's extraordinary excellence achieved and sustained. And so when we look at that, because we don't want to be that baseball team that wins the World Series one year and then you never hear from again. Or we don't want to be that organization, you know, we don't want to be Beanie Babies. That's a big deal for 2 years and then they disappear from the world. And so what does it take to do that? So we went through as a team and defined what those things are for us. Then we call them our axioms. And what are the axioms that are critical for us? And we came up with 13 of those.
Great. And that'll be in the resource that we're going to talk about at the end. Is that right?
Absolutely. We'll provide folks with that if they'll let us know their interest.
Awesome. Okay. Can you give us one of the 13
sure.
axioms?
Sure. I'll do the 13th first, and that's one of those that's going to seem soft, but it's family first. This came from the idea, you know, at Pepsi, Australia and New Zealand, they call this rule leaving loudly. Andy Stanley called it choosing to cheat. For us, it's this idea that, you know, you're going to have tension in your life. You're going to have a point that you have to choose between your family and your employer and your job. We want you to know that there is no choice. You always choose your family. And so as a leader, my daughter's now graduated from college just a year ago, but, you know, all growing up, everybody knew everything on Kelsey's schedule because it was on my calendar. And they knew I was going to every school program. I was going to every athletic event. I was going to everything. And that I expected them to do the same thing. And that if you have a sick child, stay home. Don't feel guilty. You're going to get your work done. We give you a laptop and an iPhone and an iPad. You're going to get it done. Don't feel guilty. If you're going to feel guilty worried that I'm going to find out that you didn't go to your kid's track meet or that you didn't let somebody on this team know that you needed their support to take care of your family. But as a leader, I have to demonstrate those things or those that are serving with me won't feel comfortable doing it. So it is a critical component to who we are. And it's one of those things that my board of directors said, we want you to change and do away with this, they'd probably have to find somebody else to lead the organization because I'm never going back to the old ways.
Awesome. So in a minute, we're going to transition into really practical questions. I ask all the speakers the same set of questions. But before we get to that, when I do work with leaders, one of the things that I always do, and myself candidly, is I never want to let a good mistake go to waste. Because every mistake is effectively the best chance to learn. And I'm sure you agree with that. What's one of the – you're an impressive guy. You've achieved a lot. You've been wildly successful. I can't imagine you got here perfectly without ever making mistakes. What's the biggest mistake you think you've made that also translated then into one of your best learnings?
I struggled to go – you don't like using sports metaphors, but going from a player to a player
coach.
You're
a business coach. You have to use sports metaphors. That's the only thing that's allowed in that industry.
So, it's biblical references or sports references. I've got to find a broader interest here, but fishing,
I
don't
know.
Go for
it. We have no apologies here.
Yeah, right. So... I had struggled to go from those levels, and I was driving my team nuts because I would empower them and I would give them this, and then the next thing
I got lost in the joke. So what's the metaphor? The metaphor is you were going from what to what?
I went from going from a player to a player coach to a coach to the general manager of the team.
Got it.
I got stuck in there. And I was driving people nuts, and I just couldn't see it. And I just couldn't see that I thought I was empowering them and coaching them, but it was the parent who, gets frustrated with their kid and does their homework, and that's who I was becoming. And so I have a chairman of my board of directors who's a brilliant leader who's served as a chairman of half a dozen of the largest publicly traded companies in America, set me down and said, do you have A players on your team? I said, oh, yeah, this is the gifted and talented group. These people are amazing. And he said, you're an A player? I said, well, yeah, of course. And he said, is an A a 99 and a 95? Those are both A's, right? I said, yeah, yes, sir. And he said, so why are you getting in their way? Just because you can do it at a 99 and they do it at a 95, it's still an A. And that was absolutely one of those lessons that brought clarity to my life that I don't need perfection out of my people. I don't even need them to do it sometimes as well as I do. I just need them to do it and be incredible. And what I found is now, after pulling back as a leader and becoming more of a coach and a manager, that in fact, they are better at most everything than I am. And it's one of those great lessons, but it took somebody to kind of pull the scales off my eyes so I could see that I was the professor who didn't want his students to graduate.
Interesting. That is a big lesson. I see that all the time. I especially see it in founder CEOs.
Yeah.
You know, the CEOs that have found the company and have built it and have done something really fresh and innovative, and then they bring in and hire really experienced talent who actually know a lot more than that CEO. But because the CEO flipped the script and did something really fresh and visionary, they kind of look at it and they're like, look, I know more than them. I can do this better than them, and they're not doing it the way I want. And it is maddening to the team. It's pretty
fascinating. It is, and I would have lost
the heart of. Go ahead.
No, I would have lost the team I had, and we would have failed and floundered if I hadn't have gotten that lesson.
That's right. It also cuts to the heart of one of the other biggest leadership polarities that I observe, which is the ongoing dance and negotiation between kind of the changing self and the solid self, the part of us that must be in a state of curiosity and growth and knowing and understanding we don't know and we have a lot to learn, and the part of us that's really clear and solid and knows who we are, who we're not, what we believe, what we want. And I don't know any leader who hasn't had to constantly manage this tension between these two parts of ourselves. And I think you just talked about that. You cut to the heart of that.
No, you're exactly right. And it's a constant battle.
And I was going to ask then, what's a tool or a practice or a thing that helps you stay on top of it? You know, that you learn that once, but obviously you got to keep learning it. How do you? Is there a posture? Are you oriented some way? How do you do that?
So my tool for that is appreciation. So I on Tuesday mornings, my tradition is I get up slightly earlier, about a half an hour earlier. So I get up at 5:30, and I have a list sitting in my office of my team members, those that I want to. Appreciate, my tradition is I pray over them each individually, and then I journal what are the things that I really like about that person. What are they doing amazing? And it's about an hour process, and I sit there and
wow. 'Cause
sometimes I'm not thinking about I think, well, I haven't seen them do anything. And you sit there and think, and then you think, you know what, I don't know anymore how the utility bills get paid. I don't know how we buy, you know, Diet Cokes or toilet paper. It all just happens. And, you know, it used to be I did all of those things. I knew everything. I knew the price of everything. And that level of appreciation so balances me and creates this mad crush that I have on these amazing people I get to work with every day. But I have to be conscious about it, because otherwise I turn into high-performance leadership guy, and no matter what you do, that isn't enough. We can do more because I believe in you, and you can run faster and jump higher. But if I stop and just be grateful for you, it really, really makes an incredible difference in my life.
Oh, that is such a good one. I love that one. So just out of curiosity, what's wrong with being the high-performance guy? What's the problem if I just say, you can go faster, harder, because I believe in you and we can do it, we can achieve these big things? Why not do that?
There's nothing wrong with it. It's just it can't be constant. And so it has, so we, with every member of our team, in December, set their goals for the year. And they're very specific. They have numbers attached to them. There are, everybody knows what they're going to achieve individually as teams and as the organization. It's up on the wall. So if you came into our office, you'd see a giant scoreboard that looked like Wrigley Field, and all the numbers are up there. We talk about those numbers every 2 weeks. Every member of the team has a mentor coach that they meet with every 40 days that they're talking about their goals, talking about what they want to achieve.
An outside coach or someone in the company?
Depends. So, okay. Yes, and. So everyone has one internally. About half the team has one, an external performance coach as well. Okay. Particularly those are that are in growing environments. And So you're meeting, talking about what do you need to achieve? It's a self-reporting mechanism. Hey, I'm behind on this, but I know why. We meet as a team every day. Every morning at 8:05, we meet on what we call our scrum. And we're talking about cultural things. We're talking about performance management issues. We're talking about team engagement. So with all of that going on, they don't need somebody in their ear. If you hire the right people, they don't need somebody in their ear constantly pushing them. It's exhausting. They know exactly where they need to go, and they know what their stretch goals are. And nobody wants, the metaphor of the rowing team. They don't need somebody at the end of the boat with a megaphone telling them what to do every stroke. And so, for our team, we put the expectations and the resources in place, and they manage the execution. And if they need help, they know that it's a badge of honor to ask for help, not a not something to be feared.
That's great. Awesome. So let's go into the home stretch here with the most practical stuff that I know leaders deal with and face and create stress. First, how do you lower the risk of a bad hire?
As I mentioned, we have a pretty diligent process. So we use a screening tool that's created by a company called HumanX that's based in Nebraska. And so they're giving us a strengths and talent assessment on every person. And it isn't that people aren't talented. We want to measure intensity of that talent. We want people who are, in the top 15%. We're also using Gallup's StrengthsFinder on every applicant that makes the cut. So we know that they have strengths that align with what our needs are. So you don't want to hire a fish if you need somebody to climb a tree. And we also do something fairly unique, I think. The NFL has what they call the Rooney Rule that says when they're hiring a head coach, one of the candidates has to be a minority candidate. We have a diversity rule that says when we get down to three finalists, one of those finalists must be a diversity candidate. That's very important for us. We define diversity a little bit different than just ethnicity, but it's critically important. But then once we get down to the candidates, say the 8 or 10 that have qualified based on all the previous screening, they then interview very quickly with three leaders from the organization, and where we want to get that cut down to three people, one of which needs to be a minority candidate. And then those three people interview with every member of the team. And so we'll do it in small groups. We'll do it over meals. We'll do it, over a cup of coffee. But every member of the team then is voting. And they're not voting on whether the resume looks right. We've already determined that. They're not voting on whether the they meet the standards for the pre-screen. It's already been determined. They're saying, do I want to spend half of my waking hours with this person? Do I believe this person can go at the speed of our organization? Do I believe they share the same values that we share? And so they all have, you know, a say in that. And so when you come on this organization, we never have to worry about somebody saying, well, I didn't really want her. I didn't like her. Why did we hire that person? You were part of that decision. But more importantly, if that person succeeds or fails, they succeed or fail based on your decision to hire them. And so it really becomes a mentor relationship here. Every person on the team is assigned a mentor who is not their supervisor, is not their boss, for the first year, just to get them through the organization, to explain why we do things. And we do odd things, like we only use blue ink, or, you know, we never walk by a piece of trash, no matter where we are, without picking it up. And why we do those things and what our culture is. So you have somebody who teaches you the culture. We refer to your mentor as Sacagawea. It's your guide to get you through the mountains. Lewis and Clark never get to the ocean without Sacagawea. We want you swimming in the ocean.
Yeah. And so that would be actually one of my next questions practically is, what's the best way to onboard someone? You just answered it. I mean, you guys invest heavily in onboarding. You've got a Sacagawea.
Right.
And few people do that. Yep. You often get like an hour-long orientation and then good luck.
that seems like a
really big deal that's easily overlooked.
Yeah, and you interview after you're onboarded. The first 2 weeks, you interview then every person who you met with. So then you go back, and we give you some questions that most people have their own too. And so we all know you. We want you to know us now. And so for the first 2 weeks, that person just goes from person to person interviewing every member of the team and getting to know them. And I sit down at the end of it and say, now, if you don't like us as much as we like you, it's okay to leave. But we got to pick you. Now it's your time to say you like us and you want to stay too. Nobody's ever taken me up on the leaving part. But I think it's really important that everybody knows we all opted in for you, and we expect you to opt in for us.
Oh, that's great. Okay, last practical question. And I know you haven't had to do this in a long time, but I'm sure you've had to do it. You probably had to coach others to do it. What advice do you have about terminating team members?
Yeah, and that's, a lot of what I do from my leadership is because I've had to terminate people, and I hate it. It's the hardest thing because I get to know everybody.
Especially given how you integrate.
Exactly. I know everybody here's children. Twice a year, everybody on the team and their families are in my home. I live on this great lake, and we spend a summer, a day in the summer, everybody's families. It is really hard. And so I don't want to make that mistake, which is why we hire the way we do, but I have had to. But what I do is, when I know I'm going to make that mistake, first thing I do is I get a coach. And so I believe in coaching, and I have a particular coach that I will call and say, here's what I'm doing, help talk me through this. Not the legal issues, not all of that. We have lawyers for that. But how do I be kind about it, and how do I ensure that I'm honoring the organization? And so but you have to do it fast, and you have to be kind, and it can't be two nice things and a bad thing. You've just got to be really honest and clear about it.
Great. Thank you for that. And so now, I think after people have listened to this, they realize we're talking to a guru and somebody who's got quite a lot of mastery in it. How do they learn more? Where can they get this gift? What do we need to do to get access to what you do and know?
Yeah, so they can go to ronkitchens.com. That's the easy one, ronkitchens.com. And if they go ahead and, fill in the box with their information, we'll get them a copy of Preeminence, which is the book that describes our preeminent strategies, the 13 axioms that we live by. But I would tell you that, you know, that's just an example. We'll tell you also how to do that. And so part of the digital book gives you the description on how to take your organization through determining what are the most important components that you would never give up of your organization and your culture, and how do you put those in a vocabulary that everyone on the organization can own and live by. And so we'd love for people to have that because, you know, my belief is the greatest force for change is a job. And so every organization I can help be stronger helps me live out what I believe I was put on this planet to do, and that's help organizations create jobs.
That's so great. Well, Ron, this has been an incredible pleasure for me. I've learned a ton. It's one of the joys of getting to be the interviewer of this, is to talk to all these great leadership experts. Thanks again for both everything you do in the world, for the free resource to the participants, and for the time. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's a joy to talk with you, and thank you for the amazing work you're doing out there.
Oh, glad to do it.